Welcome to The Investigation. I'm Chris Vlasto, Senior Executive Producer here at ABC News, and I'm joined by my co-host, Senior Editorial Producer John Santucci, who covers all the aspects of the Trump administration. A busy week ahead in Washington as the House impeachment inquiry begins its second week of public hearing with eight more witnesses. So we have our congressional reporter, Catherine Falders, who knows everything that's going on in Capitol Hill. So Catherine, who are the witnesses that we look forward to this week? There's two that I'm looking at. Obviously, it's Vindman Tuesday and Sondland on Wednesday, right?
Yeah, so I think you have those two. We have eight total this week. So those two we're going to be paying close attention to. And then I think it's important to watch. There's three people who will be testifying publicly who were actually on that July 25th call. So Republicans aren't really going to be able to make that argument anymore that there's no firsthand knowledge, because you will be talking to witnesses who heard what the president said, and there's some question about whether that's the full transcript or not. Gordon Sondland, though, he's going to be the center of this. He's the EU ambassador, and he's raised a lot of questions from Democrats and Republicans because, as you know, he's already had to revise his testimony twice. At first, he said he didn't think a holdup of military aid was conditioned on investigations, and then he said, oh, wait a second, it actually was, and I told an advisor to President Zelensky that, in fact, it was. He uses the word presumed in that revision, so Republicans will obviously capitalize on that. But he's important because Tim Morrison, an ex-NSC official whose deposition came out over the weekend that we were all pouring through, Morrison mentioned Sondland many times. He talks about how he didn't have much confidence in him, but he also brings up a variety of separate phone calls that Sondland says he had with the president. He says there's at least five phone calls, and it's important on those five to remember the timeline. Sondland originally said, you know, he wasn't talking about the holdup of aid with the president, but these phone calls occurred within that time period. So a lot of questions for him on that.
Well, that's a lot of information, but let's break it down first, to say, on Sondland.
Yes.
There are whispers or rumors around Washington. Is he going to show, or is he a reluctant witness? Is it possible that he could take the fifth?
I think it's possible, but at least from the sources that I've been speaking to, look, they've already come in behind closed doors. Sondland has already testified behind closed doors under subpoena. They really can't backtrack on it now. So I'm told he will show up.
You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, right?
That's right.
But now also the other point, though, Morrison, the other witness that you were talking about, over the weekend, and maybe, John, you know this too, is it said that he was the one that made the decision, right, to take the transcript and put it in the vault. And he said he did it because of a politically polarized environment. So that's good for the Republicans. That's good for Trump.
It's certainly not bad for Republicans. But I do think in all of these cases, right, there's so many people now that are going to come forward, to Catherine's point, that were on this call that are going to have different reactions to it. And I think coming out of the gate this week, having it being Morrison and Jennifer Williams, who is the NSC official assigned to Vice President Mike Pence's team, who said the call really disturbed her as she was listening to it, I do think that's going to be another thing that's going to be tough. And, you know, to the other point we were having last week, Chris, are people actually going to be watching every single hearing? Are they just going to be pulling little things away? I mean, our new poll said 21% of people watched it and were able to form an opinion on the impeachment scenario based on the hearings from last week. So this new week could be quite telling. The thing, though, that I wanted to ask you, Catherine, is, you know, for the way that I guess this next round is going to go, that just about every day, with the exception of Sondland, there's going to be two people together, right? So we're going to have Williams and Vindman coming up on Tuesday, and then another double hitter in the afternoon as well. Why are we seeing, I guess, the schedule in the way we are right now? I mean, is there a reason that they're trying to pair these people together based on your understanding?
So there's a couple things. I think there's other people also that are coming in on the same day as Sondland. But I think part of it is that they're trying to get this over with as quickly as they can, and they're adding people to the panel that perhaps had similar testimony. Fiona Hill, as you know, is by herself on Thursday, but that also doesn't prevent them from adding more witnesses to these panels. David Holmes, for example, who was that State Department official who overheard the president's phone call, who Democrats argue has firsthand knowledge. He was just behind closed doors recently.
Do they want to schedule him?
It's our understanding that they want him to speak publicly because he says that he overheard this conversation and there's other witnesses. But
isn't this all a little confusing? I mean, I understand what's going on, but if I'm, Jerry in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
That's your go-to person?
Well, no, I don't know. Am I going to follow these eight different witnesses talking about this? It sounds like a little messy to me.
Yeah, huh? just go back to like what I was saying about Sondland in the beginning. All of that information. A lot of this is, this person told this person who told this person who told Sondland who says he told the president X, hypothetically. A lot of that is like this, and that's why what I was describing earlier was so confusing.
You need almost a bingo card to kind of follow along as this goes. And then sort of like, frankly, the way we did it at a certain point, you need like, the lines connecting everybody together and why this person matters and what this person said about that person. I do think it's hard. But I guess then what other option do Democrats have? I mean, they have to get people to hear this testimony. They cannot not do them in the way they're doing. And what do they do then? Slow this down further and then drag it out? I mean, people are going to start checking out around the holidays, end of the year. There's how many working days left of Congress, Catherine, in this year? It's not much.
Not many. I mean, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think a point that John was making that I don't want to get lost in all of this week was what came out in Morrison's, that ex-NSC official's testimony, where he said that he directed that White House lawyer to perhaps put this on a different server. And Eisenberg was a lawyer who did that, and Morrison says that it was a mistake and that it wasn't necessarily supposed to go on that server. I actually think that portion of his testimony might be significant, and significant for Republicans because it possibly dismisses this whole notion of a cover-up.
Oh, that's
but
right.
But also raises questions as to why the call is still there. But the Democrats have been saying this has been a cover-up. The lawyers wanted to move it. So I think there's also going to be more info.
But after this week, what happens next? Are they going to return after the holiday and have more witnesses, or are they going to do a vote? I mean, what's the word?
I don't think we really know, though, right? Because if you look at the way that it went last week, they were suddenly adding more and more closed-door depositions out of nowhere based on what they heard from Bill Taylor's testimony at the beginning of the week. So,
and that's actually a great point because there's no we don't anticipate any more closed-door depositions or in an open setting. But to your point about Bill Taylor, since Gordon Sondland, the EU ambassador on Wednesday, is such a wild card witness in a way, since he's changed his testimony so much. Who knows what he could say that they may need to bring other people and other witnesses in?
Or they go home back to their constituency, see how it's playing, and then they come back and figure it out.
Yeah,
well, that's my guess.
And it's true, though, because the holiday is going to be the first time in the last 2 weeks that members will go home to have that opportunity of a gut check. And do I have the support? Do I not? I don't really think that's going to change the mind of House Democrats. I don't think they're suddenly going to stop if they have a town hall that doesn't go too well. I mean, they're on a mission here.
Except the polling suggests that the people do think that the president did something wrong on that call. The only disagreement seems to be whether it's impeachable or not.
Well, and even the impeachment number, though, has gone up. I mean, you're right. 70% in our new poll say that the president clearly did something wrong. 51% believe impeachment and removal from office, which is fascinating. And that's also, to I think, a conversation we had a couple weeks ago on this show, Chris, that, educating people that there's a difference in processes as far as impeachment versus a Senate trial that could be removal. But I think people are actually getting that now as we're living, breathing, and eating this every minute.
Yeah, so what's going to happen is once Intel and, of course, these other committees, Oversight and Foreign Affairs, and even Ways and Means, for example, they're also investigating the president, they'll turn over their evidence or write their report to the House Judiciary Committee, which then also could hold open hearings that I think are going to move really fast. And whether this report comes with, you know, our prediction, you know, they'll go home and they'll do it after. That could happen. But it could also happen on Thursday, hypothetically, after Fiona Hill. We just don't know. And they're not being Democrats, at least, aren't, you know, shedding any light onto that.
I think that shows what chaos lies ahead. But when we come back on the podcast, we're going to talk to Rahm Emanuel, and he knows a lot about impeachment. And he also was saying on the Sunday shows this Sunday that he thinks that the Democrats may be better off asking for a censure because they could get Republicans to come along with them. Welcome back to The Investigation. I'm Chris Vlasto, and I'm joined here by John Santucci and Catherine Falders. We have a special guest here with us today, a man who really has done almost every job in politics. He was the chief strategist and advisor to President Clinton during his term. He went on to then become chief of staff for Barack Obama, and then most recently, the mayor of Chicago, Illinois. He's Rahm Emanuel, and he's a guy who knows his politics, so we wanted to get his insights on this impeachment hearing. Rahm, we've had a lot of guests on this podcast back from the Clinton days, and basically, Republicans and Democrats agree that what President Clinton did so well during that time was compartmentalize, and that he kind of did his job as president, and you all, you know, fought the battles against the impeachment. But what did Bill Clinton maybe do wrong, or the administration do wrong there during that time that you would have done differently that could maybe shed some insight in what's going on today?
Well, let me back up a little, because you did say, I mean, you talked about the compartmentalize. There's tactics, and then there's kind of strategy, and then there's substance. So if I could break that down. First of all, the president had a robust agenda to go to work to. Can you imagine if President Trump said, I'm going to focus on the what the people elected me to do, and here's my agenda? What would he turn to?
Right.
And there's no there on any – they're not even going to get a basic funding of government done, and it's going to be probably a continuing resolution to fund it. So there was actual substance to – President Clinton's agenda. There was meat on the bone, so to say. That doesn't exist here. Two, we did effectively compartmentalize because he could effectively compartmentalize. But if we were all putting our cards and turning them over collectively from the Clinton days, it permeates. It's not a non-permeable wall. It does permeate. It does get bleed into other things that exist. And then third, I would say, and I think there's a marked difference here, President Clinton, when he did the agenda, he didn't just focus on kind of congressional. He focused on the economy, et cetera. And let me analyze this. On Friday, I think Donald Trump, the stock market was at its highest level. Now, he shouldn't be commenting, but he always does. So what does he do? Rather than focus on kind of an accomplishment or the confidence it means about the economy, he's out tweeting, attacking an ambassador that people feel empathetic to. So he has no kind of discipline on this in that level, and he is his own war room. And, you know, I think that President Clinton, by focusing, by us talking about him focusing, by being disciplined about that process through all the area, you know, he started in the low 60s and ended at the end of the Senate hearing at 68. He actually went up. And the other thing is, people didn't approve of it. They didn't think it was right for him to do what he did with Lewinsky, but they never thought it was a violation of his job. It was about certain other things they thought. It was more about, as I like, you know, his marital oath rather than his presidential oath.
The one thing, Rahm, back then, though, I mean, as you said, it was a single kind of issue, and it was very easy for the people to understand. Do you worry that for the Democrats that this phone call, although simple to understand what the president did, these hearings, especially what's coming up in this next week, they're calling like 8 different witnesses. It's a lot of hearsay circle conversations.
Here's what I worry about. Is your expectations for Trump are so low that you don't hold him accountable for the law? You know, if you go, you talk about
right.
President Clinton. You can talk about Reagan, Iran-Contra. You can talk about Nixon. I actually think the analogy for Donald Trump and how he's treating the career professionals is like Joe McCarthy. He's attacking their character, their reputation. And he did it again today as we're talking. And I think it's actually more like McCarthy. That said, what I worry about is if we are a country of laws where nobody is above the law, that people have such low expectations for this president that they permit something because that is who he is, rather than uphold the law and the office and hold him accountable for violating it. I think people get he did X, Y, or Z. I don't think anybody says, oh, he didn't do what he's being accused of. What's in the bloodstream, what's already kind of given, is, yeah, he was pressuring the Ukrainians. It's that people basically accept that as kind of he is who he is and that, you know, that is what he does.
Well, it's interesting you talk about that low bar because House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was on CBS Sunday this past weekend, and she was actually talking just about that and comparing him to Richard Nixon. It was an interesting quote she gave Margaret Brennan. Let's take a listen to that real
quick. Does the president get, as he says, to confront his accuser or get due
process? What do you mean confront his accuser? Confront the whistleblower?
Presumably,
well,
that's what
I will make sure he does not intimidate the whistleblower. So the president could come right before the committee and speak all the truth that he wants if he wants to take the oath of office, or he could do it in writing. He has every opportunity to present his case. But it's really a sad thing. I mean, what the president did was so much worse than even what Richard Nixon did. But at some point, Richard Nixon cared about the country enough to recognize that this could not continue. The Intelligence Committee is leading this part of the inquiry. There are other depositions that are being taken by more committees. So some of the depositions will continue, and then what takes place in the intelligence public will continue for another week. I don't know how much longer. I guess it depends on how many more witnesses they have. That's up to the committee. I don't guide that. That's up to the committee.
So, Ron, let's talk about that, because you said recently, and I'm going to quote you here, you said, quote, the process needs to be seen as fair, not just fast. So where we are right now, you said that a couple weeks ago, we finished 1 week of public hearings. We're entering a second week packed of public hearings. What's your scorecard so far for Nancy Pelosi and the House
Democrats?
Yeah,
I mean, I want to underscore, I believe that the posture for the best posture for the Democrats is we're just unraveling or turning over the cards of facts. We haven't made a judgment yet. We just want to see where the facts lead. And that should be the posture. And that fast can, if it's too fast, that can become the enemy of fair. That is, we're prejudging this. We have a conclusion, and now we're trying to get everything organized to back up the conclusion. We have to get everything roll itself out that the conclusion comes from the facts. And I also say that because, you know, the other side gets a play here. And I think the more we say we would like so-and-so and so-and-so to testify, and the more they say no, we would like these documents, those documents, like the most secret phone call recorded ever is in a computer with our most guarded secrets in the world. No presidential phone call has ever been in that computer. None I was a part of.
Right, and of course, you had many
people
say... Okay,
so that, to me, his denial of access to either people or material should play against our desire to get material and people forward. And I would just say, right now, you're in week, seven, in which this has occurred. I think I would say the Democrats are getting A to A minus on not moving too fast, but having kind of something that is an investigation that is dealing with how the president dealt with a foreign government and digging up dirt on a potential political opponent in the upcoming presidential election. The Democrats today are about a minus on that.
But, Rahm, you said something else interesting that kind of pivoted on the Sunday show when you brought up this idea that you think censure could maybe be a better idea in the sense that it would bring Republicans along.
Here's what I think, if you play this forward. My guess is somewhere before the end of the year, the House will take a vote. It then goes to the Senate. I think it will be hard for McConnell to just summarily dismiss it, because nobody's sitting here and saying that did not happen. They tried that with Mulvaney, and then they had to withdraw it. Oh, this always happens. No. Nobody's disputing whether it happened. Now, so I think you can't summarily get rid of it. I do think then it's going to play on a period of time. You're going to be into January and February. And I think there's a core group of Republicans. In fact, I think there's a lot of Republicans who don't have any warmth, love, or affection for this president. And they're sick and tired of defending him. That's thread A. Thread B, what Louisiana, Kentucky proved, and what Delaware County proved in Pennsylvania, and what Virginia's suburbs proved, is that Trump's mojo ain't what you thought it was. And come March, a lot of the Republican candidates who he can mess with them in a primary, the filing is over. So they have a little more latitude and a little more judgment of their own. They may not want to, 9 months before the election, remove him from office, but they're not going to say what you did gives you a pass. So they're going to probably hit him with a yellow card. They may hit him with a second yellow card, and that would be a condemnation and censure. Because I don't see Susan Collins, Gardner, Mitt Romney, Tillis, and others just saying the only vote I have is yes or no. And I think they're going to pressure McConnell hard about this. And then McConnell's in the position between protecting the president or protecting his majority.
Rom, just a quick question in terms of strategy. You say, you know, they shouldn't be moving too fast here. Do you think it's smart for Democrats to, whether it's turn over their evidence to judiciary or have a vote, to do this before hearing from the courts, for example? You know, Bolton's deputy, that case right. is in court. There's some talk about Bolton wanting to join that. Bolton's attorney says that he has, you know, significant insight into meetings that still haven't been discussed yet. Shouldn't they hear from these two, especially Bolton, who would have firsthand knowledge of this?
Look, I think those are all that's a fair set of questions. So let me go back, because what I said is you do want to move fast, but you don't want to look like you're rushing it and not be fair. I think the president somewhat has dealt with the fair thing by denying the right for people to testify, won't hand over the full transcript of the telephone. You only got basically a summary, and everybody says, look, what you do know, every lawyer that's heard about this phone call and then saw the transcript made a beeline without even stopping at the bathroom or stopping at Go to collect $200, made a beeline to the most secure computer in the United States of America. That's an incredible statement. If it's that innocuous of a phone call, or it's a perfect phone call, get it out of the database. Hand it over. This president won't. So I don't think fast should be seen as an enemy affair. It hasn't, because the president looks like he is stopping, preventing either information or people from coming forward. And I don't see him changing that. Now, I am at the time in which we're talking, I'm a little befuddled by the strategy of attacking the two women, foreign policy career professionals. For a guy who's lost dramatically among women voters, this is a unique strategy. I don't get it. And I don't think there is a strategy. I just think it's an emotional outburst constantly.
The one wild card in this whole scenario is Rudy Giuliani. And obviously there's a case in Southern
District. With the emphasis on the world, wild card.
Exactly. Yeah. But there is an investigation going on in the Southern District of New York. And couldn't we get into a scenario where you put an April timeline, maybe it's a July timeline, and he gets indicted or something? I mean, they are looking at him, and they're looking at, you know, the two men associated with him. There's some real questions there. Doesn't that feel like we're missing the star witness in these hearings?
Well, no, the star is the President of the United States. I'm not going to.
True.
Don't go chasing rabbits down rabbit holes. Giuliani's a key player. Igor, the two Russians are key players. Ambassador Sondland, key player. But the king of kings here is the President of the United States. There's plenty of room under the bus for a lot of people to be thrown. But no, there's only one person on the phone with a head of state who is demanding for all the military assistance one thing, which is that you have to turn your criminal justice system over to my political needs. And at the end of the day, we as a country, not just the legislators, not just the senators, will have to make a judgment on whether that's both ethical and legal. Now, what we do know is that when the president of the United States said to George Stephanopoulos that, of course, I would take dirt from a foreign government, Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, his own appointee, said, absolutely not. That's not right. Now, that's not a judge. That's not an interpretation of the law, even though he's a lawyer. But we do have a judgment from the FBI director of what before this phone call, we knew what he thought of something just like this would happen. Just food for thought.
Brahm, I can't thank you enough. This was very insightful and interesting. And I hope as this, unfortunately, this saga keeps going for maybe 4 more months or 5 more months, that we'll have you back.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. Please be sure to hit subscribe and leave us a rating and a comment. We welcome your feedback as our listeners. Thank you to our producers, Trevor Hastings and Caitlin Fulmer. For John Santucci and myself, thank you for joining us, and we will see you back next week for another episode of The Investigation.